Hey guys. How's it going? All right, well, good. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm writing a tweet about today's show right now. http://lrn.fm. Well, you have to put in the http://// on a tweet with a .fm. If you do it .com, you don't need to. But to make the link hot, you need to, yeah. It won't show it. But it doesn't recognize .fm as a legit thing to turn into a link for some reason. It's a strange thing, that Twitter thing. But anyway, there you go. If you can't hear me now, look at my Twitter feed and it'll give you a link to click. Except I guess you won't know that unless you're looking at Twitter or you're already listening, in which case you won't need it. But anyway. Yeah. So I'm Scott. It's my show. It's libertarian foreign policy mostly.
Which for some reason means I'm always interviewing left-wingers because...
I mean, yeah, I interview libertarians too, but left-wingers are more interested in foreign policy for some reason, I guess. Anyway. So today, Ann Jones, left-winger, Marcy, left-winger, and Mohammed Sahimi, left-winger, are all going to be on the show. I don't know how left-wing Marcy or Mohammed are, really, or Ann, for that matter. I think they're all just sort of, you know, progressives, but not too far out there. But anyway, I don't care, because Ann Jones, yeah, she's against all the killing in Afghanistan. I want to hear from her about that. And Marcy Wheeler, why, she's against the tapping of all our phones, and I want to hear from her about that. And Mohammed Sahimi, why, he wants peace with Iran. From now on. Me too. And I want to hear him talk about this great article that he wrote about Iran's deep state. Ah, man, it really is nice, huh, to be past the nuclear deal, being signed, beginning to be implemented. Now I can have Mohammed on to talk about something else for a minute. Iranian politics. Who wants to learn about Iranian politics from Mohammed Sahimi today? Me too. So that's going to be really cool. Ann Jones, Marcy Wheeler, Mohammed Sahimi. Yes, the site is still messed up. You can look at it, but yes, it's... the site circa early March 2013. At least the DNS is pointed back at the old server again. Soon, maybe today or tomorrow, I don't know, man. Maybe today or tomorrow they'll get the page updated back up to where it was before. I know people are mad as hell about this. Scott Horton, where? And you know, I appreciate it too. All the tweets and emails I get, whenever this happens, which is often my damn server problems, whenever this happens, they all use the terminology of an opiate addict. I got the shakes, man. I'm going through withdrawals, dude. I need my fix, buddy. That's what they all say. So, hey, that's very nice of you guys for liking the show. I appreciate it. Sorry about the server troubles. That's part of having freely donated very old servers that are run by volunteers when they have the time. But let's face it, we're talking about 10 million interviews of 10 million downloads of 4,000 interviews here. So, I could have never afforded to pay for the bandwidth for all this if I didn't have the hookup I got, so it is what it is. I'm going to get some new servers. See, one good thing is, I think the YouTube project is, when it eventually gets done, it'll be for free. Which at that point means the Kickstarter people who participated in the Kickstarter for the damn YouTube project that still isn't done yet. I'll email you guys then and say, hey, you want your money back or should I spend your money on a new server or two? One for backup and one for regular using. And I think probably most of you guys will want your money back, but we'll see. And then, you know, once we get the 2015 model servers in there, then they ought to not crash so often. We ought to not have to have a situation like we just had where the website was hosted on a different server. at the mercy of some company that decided to be a jerk and take it offline because of some plug-in glitch or some crap. Whatever, there's their stupid evil thing. So, see, if it had been on my own server all along, this wouldn't have even happened, but anyway. All right. So that's the show. Coming up on the show, Ann Jones, Marcy Wheeler, Muhammad Saimi. All right, so let me make sure here. Yeah, I want to talk about this. I'll do Syria in the next segment. How much time do I got? I got a little bit of time. Syria next segment. For this segment, Benjamin Netanyahu, the right-wing nationalist prime minister of Israel, came to the Center for American Progress, which is the Democrats' think tank. Right in the middle of the road there. Great article at The Intercept recently about some leaked emails about Israeli pressure on the Center for American Progress to rein in their Think Progress bloggers who, you know, are basically civil rights liberals, Jewish or otherwise, who don't take kindly to apartheid and right-wing nationalism, whether it's Israel or anybody else. Funny that. So they got in trouble. But anyway, so the Center for American Progress, they hosted Netanyahu to come and give a speech after his, you know, basically his war against the Iran deal, everything he did to humiliate their dear leader, Obama, etc. But now it's ready for Hillary time and can't be the president without Israel saying it's okay first. So gotta get back in there. So after his speech, the Think Progress blog, they went ahead and completely debunked his speech. The headline is 10 falsehoods that Netanyahu told during his appearance at the Center for American Progress. And I admit, I didn't watch the speech. There could have been more than 10. But they debunk him pretty good here. And the reason it's important isn't because of the Center for American Progress and the Think Progress controversy so much. Although, yeah, democratic politics and the role of Israel in democratic politics, all very good and interesting. But what's more important here, I think, is all the teachable moments to be had in the debunking of Netanyahu's claims. The Israeli status quo is dependent on a bunch of lies. And that's why when Netanyahu comes out and says, listen, what's going on here is totally above board, and I don't know what you guys are complaining about, he has to tell at least 10 lies. 10. In the space of one speech to just describe a different world than the one we live in. One where what Israel is doing to the Palestinians is anything like acceptable. So there you go. And then they go through and debunk. One, settlements aren't a core issue affecting the peace process. Really? I mean, why even bother claiming that? I don't know. I don't get it. Who can he convince other than the people who already agree with him when he says stuff like that? Two, no new settlements have been built for 2 decades. Oh, you mean no new entire subdivisions and cities have been built. Just the previous ones have been expanded and expanded and expanded. Massive walls put up separating the Palestinians from their property. Israeli Jewish only roads that Palestinians are forbidden from driving on. Etc., etc., etc. Oh, and the legalization of every illegal settlement. Well, we didn't legalize a bunch of new settlements. No, they just built them, and you said, no, don't do that, and then you legalized them anyway. Yeah, great, great lie. Very convincing, guys. Israel gave Gaza completely to the Palestinians. No, they just turned it into a prison. Palestinians name public squares after murderers, but Israelis don't. Yeah, of course they do. Israel was founded by terrorists, and they quote J.J. Goldberg from the Jewish Daily Forward here. Nearly all the streets in East Talpoit are named for Jews convicted and hanged as terrorists by the British before 1948. And on it goes. That was only 4 of them. It's worth reading. ThinkProgress.org.
Superior blends of premium coffee. Roasted fresh in Zionsville, Indiana. Darren's Coffee satisfies the casual and the connoisseur. Scott Horton Show listeners, visit darrenscoffee.com and use the coupon code SCOTT at checkout for free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. because everyone deserves to drink great coffee.
Hey, y'all, Scott here. First, I want to take a second to thank all the show's listeners, sponsors, and supporters for helping make this show what it is. I literally couldn't do it without you. And now I want to tell you about the newest way to help support the show. Whenever you shop at Amazon.com, stop by ScottHorton.org first and just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page. That way the show will get a kickback from Amazon's end of the sale. It won't cost you an extra cent. And it's not just books. Amazon.com sells just about everything in the world except cars, I think. So whatever you need, they've got it. Just click the Amazon logo on the right side of the page at ScottHorton.org or go to ScottHorton.org/Amazon.
All right, guys. So I did get a text there from Sneaker saying that they're working on it, man. It should be, you know, sometime. All right. Now, you know what? I want to go back to these 10 falsehoods real quick. I'm not going to read through it all, but I'll just tell you what they are. The Think Progress blog at the Center for American Progress, debunking the speech Netanyahu was allowed to give without contradiction at the Center for American Progress. I don't know if they gave him a standing ovation or what. Anyway. So he claimed, the Palestinians make heroes out of those who kill Israelis. But the Israelis don't do that. But then, of course, yeah, they did. Yeah, they do. And they quote J.J. Goldberg, not Jeffrey Goldberg, J.J. Goldberg from the Jewish Daily Forward documenting that fact as well. Number five, settlements make up just a tiny fraction of the land. That's not true. But of course, you have to take in all the area C and all the security zone and all the walls and all the separation that, de facto, as it says, 40% of the land has been rendered off limits to Palestinians. Almost half of all of the West Bank. And of course, it's all carved up into tiny little helpless Bantustans. Under a foreign government's military occupation. Number six, Palestinians won't recognize Israel. That's just a damned lie. Yasser Arafat recognized Israel back in 1988. The PLO formally recognized them on paper in 1993. And in 2000, they go on here. And I've seen even the leaders of Hamas on Charlie Rose here in the United States saying, yes, we accept the 67 borders. Just end the occupation and let us have a Palestinian state. The conquest of our land, that's a fait accompli. Up to 67, the 48 borders. I don't know exactly what all is the difference there. I guess Sinai or what. But as far as Gaza and the West Bank, they know they're not going to get the rest of all of Israel back. I mean, they say, yes, let's negotiate about the right of return at some point to kick that can down the road. But they've said, let us have our Palestinian state and we'll be more than happy to recognize Israel. Hamas has said that. And then Israel says, nuh-uh, you have to say it's a Jewish state. Well, if you're saying it is, why do I have to say it is? Because, so we can move the goalposts to make it politically intolerable for you to do that at the expense of all the non-Jewish citizens of Israel. But anyway, lie number seven. All Netanyahu wants to do is talk with the Palestinians, but they just won't talk. Well, hell, you can read in the New Republic where they did the ultimate write-up of Kerry's attempted negotiations where the Israelis obstructed them at every opportunity, all day, every day. No maps. No maps. We agreed that no one is even going to take a map out on the table and look at it until we're on stage 9 or whatever crap. It's the least honest negotiation in history. The Israelis talking about peace with the Palestinians. What they want is to kill all of them, if necessary, to steal all of the West Bank of the Jordan River, which they call Judea and Samaria. And the Christian and Muslim Arabs there can all just go drown in the Jordan River. Now, for some reason, I'm not even sure. It's not like the Democrats would stop them. For some reason, they won't just do it all at once. It's just a slow motion sectarian cleansing and grand theft of the rest of Palestine. That's the policy. And that's why they gotta lie. all the way through here. And then including, I like this, violence against Palestinians is forcefully punished. Yeah, right. Like when they burnt that family to death, the tiny helpless baby, and then the parents both ended up dying in the hospital a couple of weeks later, too. And the Minister of Defense said, oh, we know who did it. And then, but that's it. No prosecutions whatsoever. Yeah, they sure are held accountable. And then, yeah, of course, young Palestinians, young helpless Palestinians armed with rocks are terrorists for daring to resist the foreign military occupation of their land for the past 50 years. Unending. Yeah, I'm feeling pretty terrorized. Gee, you almost got me confused as to who's the perpetrator and who's the victim, except, no, that's stupid. I'll tell you what, here's how you know who's the victim and who's the perpetrator in Israel. It's real quick. Just put the shoe on the other foot. If the Palestinian Christians and Muslims had defeated the Israeli Jews over and over again and had herded them into a concentration camp in the Gaza Strip and attacked them and slaughtered them all the time, had set them up with a pretend puppet powerless Israeli authority government in the West Bank as they cut it into little pieces, stole all their water, bombed them, demolished their houses, kidnapped their children in the middle of the night like monsters, armed to the teeth, ooh, with American weapons and guns. Can you imagine the outcry? Why, that would be anti-Semitism. We would hear, I guess, fairly, we would hear analogies to Nazi Germany every single day. If it was the Palestinians, the Christians and Muslims, doing exactly what the Israelis are doing to them, to the Israelis. As simple as that. That's all you have to do is put the shoe on the other foot for a second and you go, oh my God, did you hear what the horrible terrorist Palestinians did? They attacked the poor Gaza Strip concentration camp full of Israeli Jewish refugees again. Slaughtered 1,500 of them, helpless. Call them human shields every time they blow a tiny child apart with high explosives. God, I sound like an anti-Semite just entertaining the possibility. Why, it would be immoral if somebody did to the Israelis what the Israelis are doing to others all day, every day, for generations on end. Funny how that works, huh? The golden rule. Whose Bible is the golden rule in? Is that the Old Testament or just the New Testament? The Old Testament is, do unto others before they do unto you. Right? Is that it? Well, like any of this has anything to do with the Bible. The Nazis killed all the Jews who said, wait, the Bible says that we shouldn't go back to Palestine until the Savior comes. But only the Zionists were left after the Nazis were done with the Jews of Europe, so they kind of got a monopoly on that narrative now, don't they? And a bunch of atheist communists who founded the country, by the way, who didn't believe in any of this religious mumbo-jumbo whatsoever. Anyway, same old deal. Oh, and then number 10 here. Israel's a great place for gays. This is called pinkwashing. Trying to pretend that Israel is a civil rights mecca. Just don't pay attention to any of the brown people who live there at all or any of the people with the wrong religion. Kind of screw up your narrative a little bit. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and it's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Coming up later on, Marcy Wheeler and Mohammed Sahimi. Talk about the NSA and Iran. First up, Ann Jones. She has worked with women's organizations in Afghanistan since 2002, writes regularly for Tom Dispatch, is the author of Kabul in Winter, and They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Return from America's Wars, the untold story. And here she's got a great one at TomDispatch.com. We also ran it under Tom's name, of course, at Antiwar.com. It's called Afghanistan After, quote-unquote, ironical quote-unquotes there, Afghanistan After the American War. Welcome back to the show, Ann. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks very much.
Very happy to have you back on the show here. And yeah, I was going to joke something along the lines of, well, the president said the war would be over by the end of 2014, which is almost a full year ago now. So the war must be doing really good by now if it ain't actually over, right?
Well, it's officially over. And I'm finding that a lot of Americans have forgotten all about it. We've moved on to other countries and other problems, and of course to this election. But it still goes on in Afghanistan. It hasn't ended there. In fact, now the Taliban seem to be in possession or having what's being called heavy influence in a good half of the country.
Mm-hmm. Well, and this much was obvious back at the beginning of 2014, to pick a time on the line, that this is how it was going to be, that the Americans can't withdraw without what everything they've done becoming undone once they're gone.
Yes, I think that's quite clear now. But the problem, there's also a great problem if the military stays, in that the whole time we've been there, we have put our, what we call our aid and all the wonderful things we've done for this country into the military. The military has absorbed almost all the funds that we supposedly gave to the country in aid, as well as all the funds that go to the military directly, mm-hmm. Through the Pentagon and the defense budget. So you can't win a war of ideology with the military. And we should have realized that long ago, but we keep trying to do it. And so we just keep creating more and more enemies. And this could go on, in theory, indefinitely, because we have not invested in the state, the nation of Afghanistan. That's all been pretense. You know, we put our old crony religious fanatic Mujahideen leaders, warlords, into office, and the corruption has permeated both the American position there and the Afghan governments. And so the situation just goes on and on.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, so as the government would have explained this thing to, all of us or a third grader back in 2001 or two, well, what we're going to do, we're going to create a democracy. No more of these horrible warlords and Taliban fanatics. We're going to create a system whereby, you know, you could imagine that the people will have more or less the proper amount of representation in some form of new parliament where they don't need to fight anymore because they're all participating in the system and basically you know, with relative amounts of power to their population, et cetera. And yet, all they've done is back these or those chosen groups in ways that have completely distorted their power, and they have disincluded the Taliban and everybody that they represent all this time. So now it's just a matter of all those distortions having to play themselves out and settle back down to natural amounts of power, because the Americans aren't going to keep funneling, well, I don't know, maybe they will, but assuming that the Americans don't continue to funnel tens or hundreds of billions of dollars into their military every year, they're going to have to figure out another way to do it. Right?
This is pretty complicated. Remember that the democracy that we supposedly established there, we picked the leaders and then told the Afghans to vote for them.
Right.
And most of the people we made them vote for in these elections were people that the Afghans themselves thought should preferably be tried as war criminals, or failing that, since that seemed a remote possibility, they should be excluded from holding office in Afghanistan again. But we conveniently put them all back in the government. And the Afghans do go out and vote, but the elections have become increasingly corrupt, increasingly full of fraud. And then the international community has sort of signed off on that, as though, well, this is good enough for Afghans.
Right.
So the population, which really was trying to believe in that democracy and work towards rebuilding their country, has become completely disillusioned over the years. And now this recent capture of Kunduz, the city of Kunduz, by the Taliban is kind of the last straw. And the younger generation is now leaving Afghanistan in droves.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, and as far as the elections, I remember even back in 2004, the first time that Karzai stood for election, he'd already been put in power by the Americans. But there were quotes even in the BBC where his henchmen were going around telling people, vote Karzai or we will burn your house down. And the whole thing was, they were basically terrorized into doing it. Entire villages basically rounded up and forced at gunpoint to vote for him. So that's how it's always been, is picking and choosing. Although, I kind of wonder about that. Well, let me put it this way. Hypothetically, could they have done it better? Or this is the best the American Empire can do when it comes to nation building on the other side of the planet Earth here?
Well, let me go back to your previous question about can we keep throwing money at this place? Because that, in a way, answers this question as well. Tom Engelhardt has a great piece on Tom Dispatch today about the scam of the way America makes war. Because most of this money that has been supposedly thrown at Afghanistan, or a great part of it, has really stayed right here in the United States in the pockets of the already rich. There are, you know, all the arms manufacturers and the military contractors, the private contractors who are called in to support the military and to build roads and do all sorts of construction. They're all making out like bandits. And one of the one reason we see such terrific inequality here at home these days is that a lot of that 1% is getting rich off the way America does wars. Mm-hmm. So we will keep throwing money away in this war and in all the other places we're fighting or are proposing to fight in the future. And, you know, if any of these Republican candidates wins the next election, the first thing they'll do is start a war.
Yeah.
Because it
rallies. Or the Democrats, for that matter.
Well, I hope the Democrats have learned a little something.
Yeah.
And especially, you know.
Well, I'm sorry, Ann, hold it right there. We got to take this break.
Okay.
And then when we get back, we'll talk about that. But yeah, it's certainly right what you say. Whenever I hear people say Afghanistan is the most corrupt country in the world, I say, more corrupt than America? Yeah, right.
Anyway, hold it right there. It's Ann Jones from TomDispatch.com, y'all.
Hey, y'all, Scott here for Samurai Tech Academy at MasterSamuraiTech.com. Modern appliance repair requires true technicians who can troubleshoot their high-tech electronics. If you're young and looking to make some real money, or you've been at it a while and just need to keep your skills up to date, Samurai Tech Academy teaches it all. And they'll also show you the business, how to own and run your own. Take a free sample course to see how easily you can learn appliance repair from MasterSamuraiTech.com. Use coupon code Scott Horton for 10% off any course or set of courses at MasterSamuraiTech.com.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the great libertarian social network. They've got all the social media bells and whistles. Plus, you get your own publishing site, and there are classes, shows, books, and resources of all kinds. And I host two shows on Liberty.me. Eye on the Empire with Liberty.me's Chief Liberty Officer Jeffrey Tucker every other Tuesday, and The Future of Freedom with FFF founder and president Jacob Hornberger every Thursday night, both at 8 Eastern. When you sign up, add me as a friend on there. ScottHorton.Liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, y'all, welcome back.
I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm talking with Ann Jones about the never-ending war in Afghanistan. 14 years of failure and counting. Obama, of course, announced after the Taliban took Kunduz for a while anyway, back in October, that the 10,000 troops that are there are staying. Like, we didn't know that back when he signed a deal with Karzai to stay till 2024 back in 2012. But, so here we are on our way to 2024. And talking about, well, speaking of Kunduz, you write in your article movingly about your friends who were there and, you know, what happened to some of them and what life is looking like in the seemingly near again Taliban future there.
Well, for most of this time of war in Afghanistan, women have not been able to work very well in outlying cities. Most of the women's movement has taken place in the capital. But in recent years, the organization Women for Afghan Women, which opened women's shelters in Kabul, has been able to go to work in the provinces, and they had a shelter, and they also run family centers where people who have family problems can mediate and stop some of the intense domestic violence that goes on. And they had a whole staff working in Kunduz, as they have in several different provinces in Afghanistan now. And this was a great triumph for the work of women. They've been at it for a decade or more, trying to achieve this, and they had done it. And they were the ones targeted by the Taliban who came into the city. The Taliban supposedly went around with a list looking for the women they had picked out to be exterminated, to be executed, because they were providing help to women. Most of them were able to flee the city. It's the one time a burqa comes in handy. They managed to get out of the city, and several of them made it to the capital. And then they got calls on their cell phones in the capital. So they're not safe even there. And in the meantime, of course, one of the first things the Taliban who entered Kunduz did was to burn down the women's shelter and the family mediation center. They burned or otherwise destroyed three radio stations that had been established by women to broadcast into the homes of women who were still not free to leave their homes. So the women were the chief targets from the get-go, and it would be suicide for them to try to go back to work in those provinces. And one thing that this makes clear, after all these years of talking about negotiating with the Taliban, they don't seem to have changed one bit. And of course, we had another incident. The news of this is just coming in today, of a Hazara family in another part of the country that was beheaded. Two men, two women, and a 9-year-old girl beheaded. And the beheading of women and girls in these circumstances is something entirely new. This was some sort of demonstration project, apparently, of ISIS, which is now operating in the country as well. So that protests are taking place right now in Kabul to protest this, and some of the protesters are even calling for calling upon President Ghani to step down from office. The Ghani government has been in power for a year now, and most Afghans say it has done nothing for them.
Yeah, boy, are they in a rock and a hard place. The Americans come, here we come to save you, and then they bomb a hospital, burn it to the ground, kill a bunch of innocent people over the rumor that maybe there was a Pakistani spy inside, or at least that's their latest excuse, Anne.
They've had a dozen different stories to try to explain this, but the one that seems most plausible is that the special ops people who did this, they carried out the attack for between an hour and a half. They made at least 5 runs at that hospital. So the action was clearly very deliberate, and everybody knows where that hospital is. They're very careful to, they've been there for 4 or 5 years, and they were very careful to inform all sides in the conflict, and they do their best to remain strictly neutral. So the most plausible explanation, or maybe the most generous explanation, is that these forces, special forces, were new in the country and just didn't have the information. But this is a pretty poor excuse for a military that prides itself on being such a fantastic outfit.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, when one of their excuses is, okay, we knew it was a hospital, but we're pretty sure there was a Pakistani spy in there. Whether that's true or not, the fact that they think that that makes a good explanation, where they're going to admit that, yes, we deliberately targeted a hospital, but we were hunting after one guy we were trying to assassinate while they're burning patients alive in their beds.
It's important to recognize that attacking a hospital is a war crime, no matter who is inside it. By international law, you are not allowed to attack a hospital. And very often when the U.S. has attacked the wrong people, which they do very often, have done very often all these years in Afghanistan, and they did it in Iraq as well, they use that excuse that they were being shot at from this hospital or mosque or whatever it is. And in many, many cases, of course, in most cases, that proves to be untrue. But it takes a lot of investigation and people on the ground to go and find out the truth. And very often that doesn't happen because it's dangerous to go into these combat zones and try to find out what's really going on. Yeah. And of course, most American reporters who embed with the U.S. military don't find out what's going on at all.
Right. Well, and you know, there was a statement in the recent Intercept series about the drone papers there, about the drone war in Afghanistan, where the expert consultant or whatever, the unnamed source, is explaining that no one even pretends that any of this has anything to do with America's national interest anymore. It could be that we are helping, you know, more civilized Afghans and protecting them from some of the worst Taliban, although obviously that could be disputed for sure. But nobody even tells each other inside the system that what we're doing here is keeping the American people safe. And we're talking about a war where you have people who were toddlers at the time that it started who are now being deployed to the thing.
Well, it's certainly not in the interests of America's security. Certainly not, because all we do is make more enemies everywhere we go in the Middle East. And then we try to apply more military remedies. But as I said before, it is in the interest of many Americans who make a great deal of money off this war. War has actually become the business of the United States. If you look at the way our military is organized, with bases in every state in the Union, and the way the arms manufacturers and the military contractors organize their businesses, so they are scattered all over the United States. So you try to get Congress to vote against any of this or shut any of this down, and that congressperson is put into the position of costing jobs in his home community or business in his home community, his or her. And in addition to that, he or she has probably received very handsome campaign contributions from the company or in other 1% donors who are making profits on these schemes. So the whole country, in a way, is hostage now to these military excursions that America is making all over the world, with what, more than 1,000 bases all over the world. I don't know how you turn that around, but we have to wake up to it anyway, instead of all this, you know, rah-rah for our military. And we just passed Veterans Day, you know, singing the praises of our great heroes. And I get email from soldiers who consider that a disgrace, that we civilians make these people who have already been conned into going into the military and fighting in these wars, and then we make them put on their uniforms again and line up on Veterans Day so we can say thank you. And most, I think most Americans are just oblivious to what our country is actually doing in the world out there.
Yeah, it's like you have to be a soldier to actually live like your life is a Catch-22 Joseph Heller novel for a minute to understand it. Everybody else just believes the hype. It says during the football game, rah, rah, and valor and glory. Someone was crying to me the other day. Somebody said I stole my valor, but I didn't steal it. It's mine because I was in the National Guard or whatever. Psh, what are we even talking about here? What's valorous about any of this? Nothing.
Well, we might want to mention, too, that this story that just came out recently, that the military has spent $7 million giving that to sports teams, professional sports teams, to stage big programs to honor the veterans at their...
Which is so powerful for normalizing this. In fact, I'll go ahead and commentate a little bit more on your interview than I already have. When I was a kid and growing up watching NFL football, Army, be all you can be, and Air Force, aim high, and all those things, especially during football, that did more to normalize the idea of America and its military and its military's role in the world than that. This is the way things are, and yes, thou shalt not kill, but if you wear green and you work for Uncle Sam, then it's okay. It's different, and just look at the crowd. The entire crowd of 300,000 people or whatever it is, 100,000 people watching the Super Bowl, everybody agrees. We all agree that this is perfectly fine and perfectly normal and perfectly acceptable. And you know what? I think without the NFL, if you could just get I Dream a Genie, just get rid of the NFL and all the military propaganda that goes with it, that it would be a major change in the psyche of the men of this country. But that is how we are raised, and I think that is what inculcates us in the normalcy of it all more than anything else. I mean, other than if your dad is in the Army or whatever.
I'm glad to hear you say that, because it is a terrific has a terrific normalizing effect, mm-hmm. and puts the taxpayers in the position of funding that very kind of propaganda that gets their kids into war. And in addition, we're also funding the recruitment programs in high schools, usually in our high schools in poorer neighborhoods, starting to recruit kids into the military at the age of 14, setting their little minds in gear to join the military as soon as they reach the proper age. So there is this kind of, seems to me, a corruption of our own society, a deep corruption of our own society, to advance this military program, which the farther it goes, the more we see is not at all in our country's interests, and certainly not in the world's interests, but is making the 1% even richer.
Yep. All right, y'all. That is the great Ann Jones. You can find her at TomDispatch.com. And this most recent article, The Never Ending War, is also running under Tom's name at antiwar.com. Check out her books, Kabul in Winter, Life Without Peace in Afghanistan, and most recently, They Were Soldiers, How the Wounded Return from America's Wars, The Untold Stories. Thanks again.
Thank you, Scott.
Hey, I'll check out the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism Versus Capitalism, narrated by me, Scott Horton, at audible.com. It's a great collection of his essays and speeches on the important tradition of liberty. From medieval history to the Ron Paul Revolution, Rockwell blasts our statist enemies, profiles our greatest libertarian heroes, and prescribes the path forward in the battle against Leviathan. Fascism Versus Capitalism by Lou Rockwell for audiobook. Find it at Audible, Amazon, iTunes, or just click in the right margin of my website at scotthorton.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Hey, guess what? For the first time in way too long, I got Marcy Wheeler on the line. Empty Wheel is what they call her on the internet. EmptyWheel.net is the website. It's not just her. There's a couple other guys. So one of them's really good on other legality stuff, and then the other guy's really good on Iran issues. And it's a great little blog there, man, EmptyWheel.net. Hi, Marcy, how are you?
It has been too long, hasn't it?
Yes, it has. Very happy to hear your voice again. So tell me about this thing, what I guess just came out today here on your site, How to Make Peaceful Protesters of America's Torture School Look Like Terrorists. So first of all, which torture school? Because there are a couple of different ones.
It's hard to keep these straight. I was talking about School of the Americas down in Fort Benning.
Yes.
For about 20 some years, there have been people who go and protest it because, Latin Americans who get trained there go on to murder priests and torture their dissidents. And so, lots of really honorable Americans want to shut the thing down.
Yeah. And this really has been a controversy, and really it's, protesting it is a tradition, right? You get Martin Sheen and all these people come out every year. They have for 20 years or something, right?
Right. This should be a no-brainer. I mean, let's shut the thing down and stop exporting our bad
You're
habits.
A terrorist. You are a terrorist for saying that our school, our government school where they train terrorists, should be shut down. That's what the FBI is saying?
So what they opened an investigation in 2000, and they basically said, you know, this thing won't go away, so let's investigate them. But they opened up the investigation in counterterrorism preparedness. So it's not a terrorism investigation like some of the codes that showed up on anti-war's FBI file, but it is related to terrorism, which is something else we can go back to. But what they did, Because normally what they were doing is they would just go out and they'd hang out with the local cops, and the local cops would take care of it, and they would hide all of these military police behind the walls. So in case anything bad happened, then this swarm of MPs would come out and they would, you know, take down the nuns and priests who are protesting the torture school. But what happened, what the file shows, in addition to the arrest records of a lot of people, and they kept kind of increasing the punishment of the people who would deliberately get arrested as part of civil disobedience there, is that recurrently they found things to invoke to say, this is a potential terrorist event, and kind of ratchet up the pressure. So, one of the ones I'm most interested in is in 2003, they said, golly, we have completely unsubstantiated rumors that, anarchists from the Anti-Free Trade of America's protest might come to Fort Benning, Georgia and protest with these priests and nuns and other peaceniks. And that was their excuse that year to kind of ratchet up the pressure. They're in 2009 and 8. Remember there was an investigation of a bunch of people in Minnesota and Chicago, and actually one in Grand Rapids, who had ties to Palestinians, among others, and also some socialists, some FARC people in Colombia, but not terrorists. And they were investigated for a long time. And the group had ID'd the FBI, one of the two FBI informants who had been hanging out for years with them. And those informants were present in 2009 at least. And that was the excuse for the FBI to be there. And so it's stuff like that. I mean, it's a testament to the fact that in any large grouping of people, exercising their First Amendment rights, whether it's Black Lives Matter, who, by the way, Oregon is surveilling their tweets. Oregon is surveilling the tweets of people who use the hashtag Black Lives Matter and live in Oregon. So they're being surveilled. But when groups of them come together, as we saw in Ferguson and in Baltimore, the FBI finds some reason to invoke terrorism and then start flying surveillance planes overhead. And so it seems like we're to the point where any time a group gets together, they can say, oh, terrorism, let's get out the informants. Oh, terrorism, let's get out the stingrays. Oh, terrorism, let's bring out the planes. And so that's what happens.
The stingrays, right. That's another one. That's where the cops in a plane or with their own tower preempt and mimic the local cell phone towers and grab all of our information and even listen to us, right?
Right.
Yeah, that's a big one. So now... yeah, so this is a very important thing, like you're saying. When it's not just, oh, boo-hoo, they call me some name. It means that they get to lower the threshold for quote-unquote legitimate or lawful action against you, whether it's at the protest or investigating you, maybe in trying to intimidate you and chill your speech in the first place, these kinds of things.
Yeah, although this protest has gone on so long, they're really good at they're peaceful, and the local people know they're peaceful, and for the most part, they get along. I mean, I think it was pretty touchy in 2003 because it became an Iraq protest, 2003, 2004. Mm-hmm. But, you know, they're there every year. And so every year, for this 10-year period, they were basically going, here's what goes on, and here's the school we're going to use to deploy from, and don't use this apartment complex anymore. Use this apartment complex. So it became kind of a process. I think in 2006 or so, the protesters got the 11th Circuit to say they couldn't use hand wands anymore to search for weapons. So it's an institution. It's been there forever. And it's just a matter – and also to the FBI's credit, they did at times repeat warnings that they're not supposed to be surveilling First Amendment activities, although, you know, they would stop cars and they for a while were wanding people and so on. But again, even for something that is a yearly event that has a long, long history of being peaceful, it took until 2009. And I need to go back and read the FBI's investigations guidelines, because in 2009, they're like, well, per the DIOG, per the FBI investigations guideline, it's time to shut this down. And so they finally did in 2009, but it took them, you know, 10 years of an active investigation every year they came in. And 10 years, I mean, I guess the thing that most concerns me is they would occasionally put the word out to Miami for the FTAA thing. And I think pretty much everyone in the country was doing that. But to, you know, let's call up Pittsburgh. There was a guy in Pittsburgh who got busted for some crime, and let's get all the evidence there. And it's this notion that you're going to do a network analysis of these protesters. Or they would get, there were 2 years where they would get an informant who would say, here's a nun that you should definitely look out for, because, you know, everyone knows nuns are dangerous. It's that kind of thing that is just, it's just really unfortunate and stupid.
Yeah, well, and, you know, when you call somebody a terrorist, when a government agent calls somebody a terrorist, then, you know, they could go much further than this if it comes down to it. And I guess, you know, that's the most important point of all of this is the one you made about the way the government considers any organized political action that takes place outside of the two parties. You want to participate in politics? There's your two parties. You have so much as a protest on the street and, whoa, hey, what are you doing? Trying to terrorize us into changing our policies? Oh, my God. And, you know, they even, it's almost like South Park or something, where they convince themselves of this nonsense that a bunch of hippies and Hollywood actresses and stuff are, well, I don't know how much they really convince themselves. Seems like they do a bit, and if they can deploy these kind of powers, it could lead to the situation where, as they already have it written in the law, right, Marcy, that they could put us in military prison or in Guantanamo Bay or something under the National Defense Authorization Act of 2012 and everyone since then.
Well, it's a bad precedent. You know, I think I'm more worried about what local cops are going to do, because they're
more likely to kill you sooner. Yeah, I know.
And there's a lot less visibility on what they do. And I mean, but that's sort of the thing, is that you've got this Cooties theory of policing, which says if anybody has any tie to something we consider terroristic, whether it's anarchists or people who work with Palestinians or what have you, then the entire larger group becomes tainted.
Right. Two and three hops and all that. All right. Hold it right there.
And then you get to have a law enforcement presence where you otherwise shouldn't have it.
Right. Hang on one sec. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, Scott Horton Show, and I'm talking with Marcy Wheeler. She writes at emptywheel.net. I hope you're reading. And, well, we're talking about the FBI going out of bounds in their investigations of peaceful protesters at the School of the Americas torture school there. And where we left off, we were talking about, you said you're more afraid of the local cops than the feds at this point, because they, I guess, have incorporated this same federal kind of conspiracy theory by computer form of policing. The Cooties theory of policing, I think you call it, where the computer says that this number has an association with this number, blah, blah, blah. We're talking about only data on a page, no knowledge whatsoever by the cops about what they're looking at or what any of these relations mean, except they can use their imaginations to fill in the gaps to mean whatever they want. And of course, they always err on the side against our rights and for their power. And then I guess you were saying, too, that the locals are far less transparent and accountable when it comes to how they implement these kinds of procedures and rules and technologies.
Yeah, I mean, that's the point, is when you're sharing all this information and local cops are going to be privy to it, you know, I don't trust the DEA at all. I trust the FBI somewhat more, only because it's got a better level of accountability. But, you know, you've got however many different jurisdictions and lower training levels and local tensions. And I think that, you know, so when you're giving this mandate and saying, oh, there's terrorists out there, I think that's where it's really likely to be abused, to be especially abused. And this is, you know, if you're Muslim, it's going to be abused. I guarantee it. If you are Latino and they think you have ties to the drug war, it's going to be abused. I guarantee, you know, but just generally, if you're somebody who's a peace protester or somebody who, you know, Occupy Wall Street or what have you, I just think it's in that process where things get shared with localities, you know, and even the big ones like New York, NYPD is one of the worst. And they were, during the Occupy Wall Street protests, finding one person who, a Muslim who changed his name and therefore, according to the NYPD rules, was a suspect for terrorism. And then he had cooties, and then the rest of Occupy Wall Street had cooties. And I think that's the kind of thing that happens far too often.
Mm-hmm. And then it's nobody's fault because, hey, it was the computer said. So it's really hard to hold anybody accountable.
You gotta connect the dots. You gotta, you know, it's this chainiest notion where you've got to do everything you can to defend against having something happen, and very little concern about what the presence of the cops does and how, you know, and how it changes and makes it more likely there will be violence and so on and so forth.
Yeah. And again, it's all data and ignorance, no real knowledge. And Gareth Porter has shown for years and years, back in 2011, he did a award-winning report about Afghanistan. And this is how McChrystal and Petraeus would target all the people that they'd kill in their drone strikes and their night raids and whatever. And it was all just based on this phone number was associated with this phone number was associated with this phone number. And it was a total failure. All they did basically was kill innocent people. And then I guess the Snowden documents and Intercept reporting later confirmed all of that.
Right.
They're more than happy to pretend that they have perfect knowledge when, in fact, they have the barest of information.
Well, it's they haven't tested this 2 degrees of cooties theory. And they haven't. I mean, one of my favorite, it was a horrible example, but there was a targeted killing in Yemen that got that it happened to have some stringers for American press outlets. So therefore people who were immediately, you know, had an outlet here in the States who were like, this is exactly who this guy was. Yeah. Did he talk to Al Qaeda in the Arabian Peninsula? Yeah. Was he considered a member of our community? Yeah. Is he the person that we would go to if we ever wanted to establish some kind of peace and get beyond war? Absolutely. And those are the people who get killed, because those are the people who, are considered the key people in the network, right? You know, if they're the ones that are the nexus between people who talk with Al Qaeda and people who are considered upstanding citizens, they're the ones who are going to look really interesting in a network analysis, and so therefore they're going to be the ones who get the drone.
Yep. Great example, and I bet it could go wrong 100 other ways, but that is a perfect example of how wrong it can go. All right, now, I'm sorry, in the last few minutes here, can you talk to me a little bit about, I heard that one of the courts said, hey, stop collecting all the Americans' phone data, NSA, which, didn't they already have to do that? Because, oh no, I guess not. But then another court said, nah, forget it, go ahead.
So for 3 more weeks, the old Dragnet is still operational until basically midnight, November 28th to 29th.
And that's when we switched from Patriot to Freedom.
Ouch. Oh, Scott, don't. That was horrible. Yeah, I guess that's what they want us to think. And so there have been 2 main court decisions. One is a circuit court. The Second Circuit, which is New York, basically said this program doesn't abide by the law here's what the law says you can do. And you guys have gone so far beyond the law that it's just not right. Now, they ruled that last year or this year, right before USA Freedom Act passed, and kind of kept their hands off the constitutional question. And then the ACLU came back and said, could you also tell us whether it's unconstitutional? And they said, no, we don't really feel like doing that. So in that, in New York, it is, that program is illegal, although it's legal until the 29th. Because of the way the court decided it. But the court hasn't decided whether it's unconstitutional or not. In the D.C. District, which is the lower court level, the first level of court, a judge by the name of Richard Leon, way back in December of 2013 said, whoa, this is unconstitutional. And that got appealed up to the D.C. Circuit. And they said, we don't think these people have standing, which is the, you know, which is the way everything gets punted on surveillance issues. It was kind of a dumb decision, but that's what they said. And they're, you know, they're circuit judges and I'm not. So they punted it back to Leon to say, is there anything more to do with this? And Leon said to the plaintiffs, one of whom is Larry Klayman, they said, go get somebody who has unquestioned standing. So go get somebody from a different phone company who works with a different phone company. So he did that. And Leon said last week, for this one person, JJ Little, who's a lawyer in California, I enjoin, I'm going to stop the dragnet. They can no longer collect your phone records. And the government was sort of like, yeah, buzz off. I mean, they were very contemptuous. But you know, the net effect is a day later, they got the DC circuit to issue an emergency stay. There's going to be briefing on Friday and Monday, and we'll see whether JJ Little, one lawyer in California, gets to have his phone records, protected. which the government says is going to shut down the entire dragnet. And the, you know, they're engaging in such bad faith at this point that I just wish judges would make fun of them. But judges aren't going to make fun of them on the technical issues. But, you know, it's just nonsensical. It's what they're saying is largely nonsensical. But they're saying that so as to say, oh, my gosh, if you protect JJ Little, then everyone else in the United States will go unprotected. And therefore, you can't make us protect JJ Little. So that's kind of what the government is arguing. Not all that convincingly to me. But then, you know, I know a lot about this dragnet and these judges don't.
Yeah. I wish you were the judge. That'd be better. All that stuff would have been struck down a long time ago.
I know, and then I'd also strike down all laws with euphemistic Orwellian names like freedom and patriot.
Yeah.
As a general rule.
That should be a constitutional amendment against those. All right. Hey, thanks, Marcy, very much. You're the best.
All right, take care.
All right, y'all. That is the great Marcy Wheeler. She writes at emptywheel.net. Emptywheel.net. And, boy, she's good on all of this surveillance stuff, especially. We'll be right back in just a minute with Mohammed Sahimi.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. If this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Up next, it's our friend Mohammed Sahimi. He's a professor of chemical engineering at the University of Southern California in Los Angeles. And, well, he's a peace activist on America and Iran issues, an Iranian expat, and loves Iran, hates its government. And always writes interesting stuff. Every single thing is great. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Mohammed?
It's good to be back in your program, Scott. I'm not too bad.
Good, good. All right, so very interesting article that you wrote here. You know, It's kind of nice to see, just because finally we're past the nuclear deal actually being signed. Can you believe it? And it's begun being implemented. It's under no significant challenge at this moment anyway. And so, hey, we can take a breath and stop and write about something at least, you know, tangentially related, but other Iran issues besides just the fake nuclear scare for the first time in years here. It's kind of nice. So, anyway, this is related, a related issue, of course. Iran's deep state has the most to lose from opening to the West. And you really get into the nuts and bolts of Iranian politics here. I guess let's start with the supreme leader and the president and their relative positions in the battle between, I don't know how you label them, left, right, moderate, center, old, new, less or more religious, or however you want to break it down. Please, sir, go right ahead.
Well, Iran is going to have two important nationwide elections in February. The two elections, one of them is for Iranian parliament, the other one is for what we call the Assembly of Experts, which is a constitutional body that appoints the supreme leader and can theoretically even fire him if he's not performing well. Now, these two elections are very important for a variety of reasons. First of all, in the present Iranian parliament, the hardliner make an important faction, and they oppose the nuclear deal with 5+1. And they made a lot of noise, they made a lot of accusations, and so on. The Assembly of Experts is important because, as I said, it has the authority to appoint the supreme leader, and there is a lot of credible reports as well as rumors that Khamenei is not going to last much longer. He has been ill for quite some time. Last year he was hospitalized, and even he himself, in a speech a few weeks ago, alluded to the fact that he won't be around in 5 to 10 years. So that means that the new Assembly of Experts that will be elected in February will most likely choose the next supreme leader. So that means that conservatives and hardliners led by Khamenei want to prevent the moderates and reformists to get into the assembly so that if the time came for electing and appointing his successors, they can have influence. And that has worried Khamenei and the hardliners. Now, the hardliners, what I call the deep state in my article, are basically the Revolutionary Guards, intelligence forces, and their supporters in besieged militia and so on. They use Khamenei in order to advance their goals by using Khamenei as the supreme leader of Iran in the framework of Iranian constitution. They gave some sort of legitimacy to what they want to do. They were hoping that Iran and 5+1 will not reach the nuclear agreement because Khamenei had set some red lines and had declared that these red lines cannot be crossed. But the Rouhani administration and the foreign minister, Mohammad Javad Zarif, actually crossed some of those red lines and reached the agreement. Now, Khamenei did want and still does want the agreement, but he's afraid of its consequences. One consequence is that Rouhani and Zarif and moderates and reformists are now highly popular. Election in February, they will take control of the Majlis, the parliament, and also will send at least several younger moderate clerics to the Assembly of Experts, and that has have them very concerned. At the same time, the IRGC, which is the main military force in Iran, also has an economic empire. During the Ahmadinejad administration, the IRGC linked companies and IRGC engineering arms, which is called Khatamul Anbiya headquarters, got a contract from the Ahmadinejad administration worth tens of billions of dollars. The Rouhani administration hasn't done the same. In fact, it has called for military to move out of politics and economy, go back to Barak, and just does what it's supposed to do, namely protecting Iran's national security territorial integrity. This is not what the hardliners want. They are afraid that if the trend continues in Iran, they will lose their economic power and therefore they will lose their political power. Or, looking at it another way, if they lose the elections, the hardliners lose the elections, upcoming elections in February, they will lose the political influence and with it will come loss of economic power. So they have been attacking Rouhani, Zarif, and other moderates. And in order to do that, they basically hide behind what Khamenei has been saying. Since July 14, when Iran and 5+1 signed the nuclear agreement, Khamenei has been basically lashing out at the United States. And in a speech after a speech, he has attacked the United States. He has warned about the United States trying to, he says that the United States wants to infiltrate Iran again and gain undue influence. He has claimed that the United States wants to have its agent to be in the Majlis, the parliament, and important organs of the government so that the decision for them can be made by the United States. You know, all sorts of imaginary things that he has been talking about. Now, what happens is that the deep state, the IRGC, intelligence forces, and so on, use his Khamenei's speeches to advance their program. And at the same time, the judiciary, which is also controlled by the hardliners, has been going after journalists, human rights advocates, and so on and so forth. People like me always said that criticism of Iranian government and the Iranian regime is a completely separate issue from being a peace activist and being against sanctions and military threats and so on. Now that the sanctions are going to be lifted gradually and the threat of war has been lifted from Iran again, so people like me who are opposed to the Iranian regime have started writing about these issues because these issues are important. At the same time, when Rouhani was running for elections in 2013, he promised the nation that he will do his utmost to free Iranian political prisoners and open up the political system. So far, he hasn't done that. But up to now, it was understandable because he was busy trying to reach an agreement with 5+1 to get the economic sanctions lifted, to get the shadow of war lifted over Iran, and so on. But now that that has been achieved, people like me expect him, and you know, I am one of millions, expect him to either deliver on his promises, or if he cannot, and the reason that he cannot is that the deep state prevents him, he should explain it clearly and transparently to the nation so that people know what's going on in Iran, who holds the power, who prevents, you know, moderates, reformists, to open up the system, make the system more humane, you know, bring investments from all sides and so on.
Yep. All right, y'all. We're talking with Mohammed Sahimi. He teaches chemical engineering because he's a professor of chemical engineering at USC. And here he is writing in the National Interest, nationalinterest.org, and we're running it on antiwar.com as well. Iran's deep state has the most to lose from opening to the West. Very interesting discussion of Iranian politics, and we'll have more of it right after this. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for MPV Engineering. This isn't for all of you, but for high-end contractors specializing in industrial construction and end users who own and operate industrial equipment. MPV offers licensed professional consulting on chemical and mechanical engineering for your projects. Tanks, pressure vessels, piping, heat exchangers, HVAC equipment, chemical reactors for oil companies or manufacturing facilities, as well as project management support and troubleshooting for those implementing designs. MPV will get your industrial project up and running. Head over to mpvengineering.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new ebook by longtime Future Freedom author Scott McPherson, Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms. This is the definitive principled case in favor of gun rights and against gun control. America is exceptional. Here the people come first, and we refuse to allow the state a monopoly on firearms. Our liberty depends on it. Get Scott McPherson's Freedom and Security, the Second Amendment and the Right to Keep and Bear Arms on Kindle at Amazon.com today. All right, y'all, welcome back. I'm Scott Horton, and I'm talking with Mohammed Sahimi. If you click on more viewpoints on the front page of antiwar.com, you can find this link. It's at nationalinterest.org. Iran's deep state has the most to lose from opening to the West. So, Mohammed, I noticed that whole time in the first segment there where you're describing the state of Iranian politics there, it seems so obvious. And I guess, come on, it's not just hindsight. We've said this all along. You've certainly said this all along. But it's just so obvious and clear now that the Israelis and the right in America and everyone who has demonized Iran over their nuclear program and has tried to prevent any reconciliation of our two countries have been the useful idiots of the IRGC and the Ayatollah and the hardline Iranian right that they claim to hate so much and have been undermining the position of moderates and reformers like the current president, Khatami, for example. And now that he's been able to successfully reach this peace deal with the Americans, de facto peace deal, basically putting the biggest fake issue outstanding to bed finally, he's benefited so much that now you're already skipping ahead to the possible backlash from the right as to just how successful he is in terms of popular opinion, in terms of moving the entire country toward a more reformist and moderate direction.
Oh, I totally agree. I've always said, you said, and people like you and I have said many times, that the neocons in this country and Israeli right and Netanyahu and so on, all they do is basically support the position and what the hardliners in Iran want to do one way or another, directly or indirectly. When Ahmadinejad, for example, was running for a second term in 2009, many Israeli officials made it very clear that their preferred candidate in Iranian election was Ahmadinejad, because Ahmadinejad was doing everything that he could to provoke the Israelis and neocons in this country, and they also wanted him to come back for a second term, so that they can use him and what he and his supporters were doing as their excuse to justify what they were saying about Iran's nuclear program. So, in fact, I wrote an article and published an anti-war just a while ago in which I said that Western media and neocons and so on basically they give excuses to IRGC in Iran and hardliners to persist in what they say, in what they claim, and so on. And now we see the effect of it. The hardliners didn't want any nuclear agreement with 5+1, just as Israel and neocons didn't want any nuclear agreement. The hardliners want to prevent implementation of the agreement. In fact, just a couple of days ago, there was a report according to which Iran's Atomic Energy Organization president, Ali Akbar Salehi, who played a very important role in the nuclear negotiation, said that Iran has stopped setting aside some of the centrifuges because there was a political pressure by hardliners. And they were complaining that Iran was doing this too fast. So they want also to slow down, if they cannot stop, implementation of the agreement. And of course, that provides, some excuses for Israel and neocons on this side in our country, in the United States, to again make claims against Iran. So the two sides basically need each other, mm-hmm. and in this battle, what we have is a moderate administration led by Rouhani and Iran Foreign Minister Zarif, which is also supported by a very large extent by Iranian people, because they want to advance the country, to open up the political system, to get rid of the vast corruption under Ahmadinejad. There is hardly a day in Iran that goes by without any new revelation about the vast corruptions that we had in Iran under Ahmadinejad. Right now, this guy is on trial in Tehran. Everybody believes that he has deep links to IRGC, the deep state, as I call it. And he amassed about $17 billion over a period of 5 or 6 years. And he could not have done this without his connections to the security intelligence organizations and people who do a lot of things behind the scenes. So, you know, by continuing to make accusations against Iran, by making, continuing to target Iran, just like Netanyahu did this past couple of days when he went to Center for American Progress and said that Iran and, you know, Islamic radicals wants to take over the world, but Saddam Hussein was just a local bully. And he's the same guy when they wanted to invade Iraq, said that Saddam Hussein is a threat for the peace of the entire world. So now he is still is ranting against Iran. And this, of course, provides the excuse and the background for the hardliners in Iran and saying that, you see, we made all these concessions, we reached the agreement, we are trying to implement it, but they don't leave us alone and they are again after us. Which, of course, to them is an excuse because they didn't want this agreement in the first place. So they have been attacking Rouhani, they have been attacking moderates, they have been arresting journalists, they have been arresting human rights advocates, and they have not been releasing political prisoners whose terms of incarceration have ended. So here we are in this situation. And, of course, President Obama himself has also a role here, I must say, because President Obama keeps saying that, yes, we reached this agreement with Iran, but we are still about Iran doing this or concerned about doing that. Whereas in reality, if they actually want to end the war in Syria and end in Iran's involvement and Russia's involvement in Syria and leave Syria alone, they actually need to work with Rouhani administration, because Rouhani also wants the war in Syria to end, because it is a big drag on Iran's economy. It is the casualty of Iranian military personnel in Syria has been going on rapidly. And Zarif and Rouhani both want to help end the war in Syria so that they can concentrate on Iranian affairs and reviving Iran economy and hopefully opening up Iran political system.
Yeah, it's really a great microcosm of the last decade, and that's why you and I both seem so prescient on this, is just because we've been talking about it, we've been covering it for a decade now, and it's the same thing year in, year out. But that example, or that series of a couple examples there, really just illustrates the whole larger narrative in a microcosm, where the Americans say, stop dismantling your centrifuges so fast, because we can't repeal our sanctions in a way to keep pace with you, so slow down. So then the right-wingers in Iran say, fine, we will slow down then. And then the war party in Israel slash America say, look, they're slowing down the centrifuges. And then the right wingers in Iran go, oh, look at them demonizing us. Well, we're going to go ahead and act out by clamping down on political dissenters and this and that. And still, even after the damn deal is signed, you still have the same back and forth, back and forth. And it's so plain to see right in front of all of our eyes how it works. And of course, oh, and then I left the last step out, which is the American and Israeli side pretending that they don't know that Khatami, the president, is basically incapable of doing anything about these political prisoners and whatever, that it's his political opponents who are behind this backlash, and they just demonize Iran in general, ignoring the role, covering up their own role in inciting the Iranians and the Iranian right and making things the way they are in the first place, of course.
I totally agree.
It's just
incredible,
really, to think that they can get away with this. Nobody ever calls them out.
Yes, I totally agree. And in fact, I'm glad you brought it up. We both know that a couple of weeks ago, the Obama administration official was saying that Iran is removing the centrifuges too fast. And this is of concern to us because we cannot lift the sanctions as fast. So the right wing is in Iran pressured and, you know, said don't remove these centrifuges as fast. And then this is again used by neocons and Israel and so on and say, oh, yeah, they're backtracking on their obligation.
It's incredible.
It really is incredible. So how these two sides, the two sides that didn't want a nuclear agreement and didn't want peace, feed each other constantly.
Well, and they only got to get it past Wolf Blitzer, right? He's the only goalie we got to say, well, wait a minute, that kind of doesn't make sense. But he's never going to be confused enough to even ask the question because he doesn't get it in the first place. So
Precisely. I totally agree. I mean, in the case of Wolf Blitzer in particular, I totally agree. He just doesn't get it. He just doesn't get it.
Yeah. Well, and he's just the perfect stand-in, too. He's like the brand name Kleenex stands for all tissues. Wolf Blitzer is all news anchors. They don't ever understand it enough to even ask the hard question. But anyway, so that's why we've got you. And good thing about that, too.
Thank you very much, Scott. And as I said, we will, people like me are now, we not only we write about, the impediments to implementation of nuclear agreement and try to educate as much as we can, given what we know. We will also write about Iranian politics because this Iranian politics is in direct connections with implementation of nuclear agreement, what's happening in the Middle East, where Rouhani administration stands, where the reformists stand, and so on. So this is not a story that has ended by any means or any chance. This saga is going to continue. As I said, Netanyahu at Center for American Progress again targeted Iran, again said that Iran is a threat to world peace, and downgraded Saddam Hussein from a threat to the world peace to the neighborhood bully. And
of course, conflated the Islamic State with Iran as though that's the same thing.
Oh, yes.
Get it? Islamic.
Exactly. This is another thing that he has done. He has always said that Iran and the Islamic State are one and the same, whereas Islamic State is an arch enemy of Iran. I mean, they hate Shiites. They hate Iran. And they are fed by some of the wealthiest Arabs in the Arab world, in the Middle East, not to mention the fact that they have been doing a lot of dealing behind the scenes with Turkey because they are producing like 50,000 barrels of oil a day, and they sell it in markets in Turkey and elsewhere, and without at least tacit support of some elements in Turkey, the Islamic State would not be able to sell 50,000 barrels of oil per day. So these are basically against Iran, against the Shiites, against Shiite influence, and of course they blow it all out of proportion, but for example, Iran has been doing in Syria. I'm against Iran intervention in Syria, just as I'm opposed any foreign intervention in the Middle East. I'm also against Iran's intervention in Syria. But Iran is not the only country that has intervened in Syria. Saudi Arabia and its allies in that region have been involved in Syrian civil war from the beginning. They have supported these terrorist groups in Syria. Joe Biden said at Harvard University in October of 2014 that, you know, Saudi Arabia, Qatar, and their allies in the Persian Gulf area wanted to get rid of Bashar al-Assad so badly that they were willing to arm and provide funds to anybody who was willing to fight with Bashar al-Assad. And then he said, but unfortunately, the only ones who are fighting Bashar al-Assad are these terrorist groups, Al-Qaeda in Syria, Islamic State, and so on. So Saudi Arabia and their Arab allies have been supporting these groups in Syria. At the same time, I don't see a lot of discussions in this country about Saudi Arabia's bloody intervention in Yemen. I mean, this country, Saudi Arabia, has been attacking Yemen since March. Thousands of civilians have been killed. The country has been destroyed. And that has provided an opportunity for not only Al-Qaeda, for Islamic State to go back to Yemen and have bases there. So, and at the same time, they have been accusing Iran of intervening in Yemen. Whereas if you, for example, read analysis by objective experts, such as people in International Crisis Group and so on, they say that Iran does not consider Yemen as strategically important to its interest, and Iran was not actually involved in Yemen before the attack on Yemen started. But in order to bloody Saudi Arabia knows that has intervened in Yemen, Iran may have been trying to give some support to Shiites, Houthi Shiites in Yemen since the war started. But even then, we still don't have any firm evidence for it. Iran sent some aircraft there to give them some humanitarian aid, but Saudi Arabia and prevented those aircraft from landing in Yemen, and therefore they were returned. So we really don't know what's going on. But at the same time,
let me add here real quick, just to help bolster your argument a little bit. The President of the United States himself, Barack Obama, has admitted that the Iranians warned the Houthis not to take the capital city of Sana'a, which became the excuse for the war by the Saudis in the first place. So, which is quite counter to the Iranian-backed Houthi movement.
Yes, I totally agree. I mean, I'm not saying Iran was not or is not involved in some way in Yemen, but what I'm saying is that it isn't what they say. And in fact, as New York Times put it a while ago, this has become a sort of self-fulfillment or self-prophecy or whatever, however New York Times put it, in the sense that before Saudi Arabia attacked Yemen, Iran really wasn't involved in Yemen. But since Saudi Arabia started attacking Yemen, and in particular the Shiites, Iran started raising its voice. The rhetoric started coming out of Tehran. They sent some of their Navy vessels to the waters around Yemen without actually doing anything. They sent some cargo planes to give them humanitarian aid. But Saudi Arabia, accused them that they were not humanitarian aid. They were actually weapons, and therefore they did not allow them to land and so on. But at the same time, we don't see any, meaningful discussion of what Saudi Arabia and its allies have been doing in Yemen. And the Obama administration has been playing it both ways. On one hand, they say that we are worried about the human consequences of what's happening in Yemen. They have been saying that they are worried about Al-Qaeda and Islamic State going back to Yemen. But at the same time, according to all reports and by the admission of the administration itself, they have been helping Saudi Arabia logistically and resupplying its weapon that has lost in Yemen, and basically having a very major important role in what Saudi Arabia is doing in Yemen. And while at the same time, all sorts of accusations have been pointed towards Iran. So this is just a continuation of demonizing Iran, demonizing what Iran is about in order to advance their agenda, which is basically continuing the war in the Middle East, spreading the bloodshed in the Middle East, and the design that some at least have in this country, namely disintegrating these countries, partitioning these countries into a small, weak state so that, they can control it, so that Israel can advance its agenda. Netanyahu, New York Times reported just today that Netanyahu hinted to the president when he met with him in the Oval Office that given what's happening in the Middle East, the United States must recognize the fact that Israel annexed the Golan Heights in 1981. I mean, what does that have to do with that? Golan Heights is part of Syria territory. So eventually, hopefully, a good government will take over in Syria and it would still want its territory back. So opportunistically, he wants the United States to recognize annexation of a part of another country to Israel because the Middle East is in bloodshed. But who created the bloodshed? The same people. Who started this war? The same people. Who started all of this invasion of Iraq by George W. Bush administration? Who attacked Libya? The United States and NATO. And all of these have come together, but we don't see really a good discussion of this. And at the same time, everything we hear about it is Iran did this, Iran did that, Iran did this, Iran did that. I mean, this is not just tenable. It's not that Iranian hardliners and Iranian political system is without fault. They have their own fault. They shouldn't have intervened in Syria, but they have done it because they consider supporting Syrian government to be in their strategic interest. But Iran is just one player in that region. There are many, many other players, both in the Middle East and from outside. So just talking about one player out of many is just doesn't make sense.
Yep. Well, and, you know, it could be added, too, there that, well, a couple of things. First of all, the L.A. Times and the Wall Street Journal have both done extensive reports about American support. Basically, they're coordinating the whole air war and providing the aerial refueling for the Saudis. Of course, American contractors do all the maintenance on the planes. The Saudis don't do manual labor, of course. The Americans put in the GPS coordinates. The Saudis fly there, drop the bomb, and come home, that kind of thing. Otherwise, it's Obama's war. The whole damn war is America's war over there. You could even look at it where the Saudis, in a way, are just flying as part of our Air Force. And yet, all reported, oh, and of course, this is all to the benefit of Al-Qaeda on the ground. While the drone strikes against Al-Qaeda continue against selected assassination targets, they're actually helping accomplish Al-Qaeda goals against the Houthis and helping them expand their territory. They've taken an airport and a seaport and a weapons depot that used to belong to the army there. Weapons that America gave to the dictator Saleh to fight Al-Qaeda with in the first place, probably. That had also been used against the Houthis and provoked them into being the problem that they are at this point. You actually have America fighting for and against Al-Qaeda at the exact same time in Yemen right now. In the middle of this war over there. And then I've seen this reported over and over again. I guess it's almost always anonymous sources, Mohammed, but the wisdom, the conventional wisdom in D.C., the understanding apparently is that the reason the Americans are happily doing this for the Saudis is it's a sop to them over the Iran deal. If you'll pipe down about the Iran nuclear deal, which could have been said to have been done for Saudi interests in the first place, taking a safeguarded nuclear program and making it ever more safeguarded than before. Instead, oh, sorry, boo-hoo, we're so apologetic for doing the nuclear deal, which benefited you, Saudi. We'll go ahead and help you have a war against the Yemenis, the poorest country in the entire Middle East.
In fact, I said the same thing in an article and that was published by Huffington Post. I said, the Obama.
Well, and it ain't just you. I mean, this is the consensus. I've seen it over and over again that, well, why are they doing this? Well, it's because of the nuclear deal. We've got it. It's our apology to them. Just like giving Netanyahu a raise from $3 billion to $5 billion a year.
Yes, I totally agree. I totally agree. And you see, the Obama administration justified, first of all, it supported the ridiculous development that Saudi Arabia became the head of Human Rights Council at the United Nations. I mean, this is a country that is basically a religious dictatorship of the worst kind at home and has been waging a war of aggression against Yemen, against Syria. Its citizens, if not its government, has been supporting all sorts of terrorist groups. 15 of its citizens were involved in 9/11 terrorist attacks and so on. But the U.S. applauded the fact that Saudi Arabia, I don't know how, but it was basically appointed to lead the Human Rights Council or one of at least one of its committee. This is one thing. Then the other thing is the U.S. tries to justify what Saudi Arabia has been doing in Yemen, repeating what the Saudi Arabia government saying that, you know, we are doing this at the invitation of the legitimate government and legitimate president of Yemen. Well, if that's acceptable, which is not, then why isn't it acceptable for Iran to intervene in Syria? After all, Iran and Syria have a mutual defense pact signed in 2006 and registered at the United Nations that if any one of the two countries was attacked by foreign forces, the other country must support the other side. Again, I want to make clear that I'm against Iran's intervention in Syria. But what I'm trying to say is that because of the nuclear agreement with Iran and because of the fact that this nuclear agreement in Iran with Iran made a lot of actors in the Middle East unhappy, just like you said, the Obama administration has been doing a lot of things to appease them, including helping Saudi Arabia and Yemen, including increasing military aid to Israel, including closing its eyes on what Turkey has been doing in Syria, and including continuing the threats against Iran, that if you guys don't do this and if you guys don't do that, then everything is on table again, and so on and so forth. So this is really, just like you said, this is really a war, America war, and Obama administration war, with all these actors. And in the middle, we have defenseless people of Iraq, Syria, Yemen, Iran, and so on, being victimized by these policies.
All right, y'all. That is the great Mohammed Sahimi. He is a professor of chemical engineering at USC. And here he is writing in the National Interest. Oh, I should say he's got a great archive going back for years at antiwar.com. And here he is at the National Interest. Iran's deep state has the most to lose from opening to the West. Really appreciate your time again.
Thank you very much, Scott.